The older you get, the less you party. You can't be bothered. A Day in the Life of Steve Redgrave by Sarah Ewing in The Telegraph. Born in Marlow, Buckinghamshire, Steve Redgrave became a dominant figure in world rowing across two decades, collecting multiple world championship titles alongside his Olympic success. Since retiring from competitive sport, Redgrave has remained heavily involved in athletics, charity work and broadcasting, while also campaigning to raise awareness of type 1 diabetes, which he was diagnosed with in 1997. A keen skier and golfer, he lives in Buckinghamshire with his wife, the former Olympic rower Dr. Anne Redgrave, and is now enjoying life as Grumps to his growing number of grandchildren. 8 a.m. I'm not one of those relentlessly perky morning people. I hate mornings. My best sleep tends to be at dawn rather than in the middle of the night, so getting up has never been my favourite thing. That said, I had a taste of routine thanks to Dancing on Ice, and oddly, I enjoyed it. It was all-consuming. 2 hours on the ice, 5 days a week, plus warm-ups, stretching, physio, and the travel to the rink on top. I hadn't lived like that for 25 years. Some of the people I was competing against weren't even born when I won my last Olympic gold medal. But being back in a structured process, knowing what you're doing each day, was strangely satisfying, even though I hated that level of routine by the end of my rowing career. 8:30 a.m. Breakfast matters to me. I'm type 1 diabetic, and the reality is simple. Every time you eat, you have to balance it with insulin, and if you exercise with insulin still active in your system, your blood sugar can plummet quickly. So my morning is practical. A cup of tea and a bowl of cereal. That'll mean roughly 6 units of insulin. I'm on an insulin pump now, which gives me a small amount all the time, about 1 unit an hour as a baseline, and it's improved my control because I can adjust more quickly. Years ago, when I injected manually, I'd often inject after eating. It's not ideal, but if you're at a charity dinner and you genuinely don't know what you'll be served, you do what you can. The pump makes the whole thing smoother. People talk about routine, but with diabetes and with my life generally, you can't always have one. You deal with what's being thrown at you. 11 a.m. My me time is not very glamorous. I watch sport on TV. Honestly, I'll watch anything. My son played rugby to a decent level, so I've always followed it. And I played a bit myself, not very much. But sport is still my comfort viewing. 1 p.m. If I'm out and about, my dog comes with me a lot, especially when I play golf. She's an excellent golfing dog. She loves balls, but she's learnt she's not allowed to chase the golf balls. Halfway around the course, she gets very focused on one thing, the halfway house. That's the only time she'll start pulling, because she knows she'll get treats, and the woman who runs it adores her. I play off 13, which is respectable. I wish it was better, but then I wished I was a better skater too. The difference is I was a half-decent rower once. 3 p.m. I'm also a skier, and I'm spending my weekends planning my next trip at the moment. These days I ski the Trois Vallées more than anywhere else. It includes Courchevel, Méribel and Val Thorens. I first skied on a school trip when I was 9 or 10 and loved it. Then I didn't ski again for more than a decade. Years ago, a friend roped me into pushing him at the British Bobsleigh Championships, even though it was his first time. The first time I went off the top of a run was with a top driver at Winterberg in Germany. I was, frankly, terrified. The day before, another sled slid into tyres on the braking straight and the driver broke his arm, so the timing wasn't ideal. But the run itself was smooth, and I remember throwing all my weight onto the handles on the brakes and the sled stopping dead. The course is much safer now. The last bend has been redesigned so you're not heading towards tyres and trees. I'm a very visual skier, so whiteout conditions are hard work. I can get down moguls, but I grit my teeth doing it. My knees aren't thanking me. 6 p.m. I'm not really a cook. I like the idea of cooking, and I can survive if I have to. When the kids were younger, spaghetti bolognese was my go-to, and I put Worcestershire sauce in just about everything. I don't do recipes. I open the fridge, see what's in there, and throw something together. It's decent 99% of the time, and then there's the other 1%. My kids are excellent cooks. My wife is too, and yes, I think she'd like me to cook more often. 8 p.m. I don't go out as much now. The older you get, the less you do dinners and parties, partly because you can't be bothered and partly because it takes longer to recover. We do still do the occasional event. We went to a movie premiere recently, and I'm the sort of person who gets very caught up in the morality of what's going on in a story. Loyalty, responsibility, what's right. I can't help it. That's just how I'm wired. 10 p.m. Saturday night, I'm not out for the count early. I'm also not a great sleeper, so it's not as simple as staying up late for the fun of it. And somewhere in the middle of all that, sport on the telly, golf, skiing plans, and the constant balancing act of diabetes, there's a part that makes me happiest at the moment, family. I've got a young granddaughter and she recognises me on television, pointing at the screen and shouting, "Grumps, Grumps!" That became my name because apparently my general demeanour can be a bit grumpy. I keep saying to my kids, get the little ones in the boat early, because you never stop being a rower. You just learn how to do it in a different rhythm.
Sight Loss Friendly Holidays from Blind Veterans UK website. Sun, sand and sangria. Most people love the idea of jetting off on a summer holiday. But for those living with sight loss, getting away can often feel more stressful than relaxing, even if you're staying in the country. Luckily, help is at hand. These days, you can book accessible, supportive holidays designed specifically with your needs in mind.
How to prepare. As tempting as it can be to just pack your bags and jet off, the more prepared you are, the better, and the following tips can make all the difference. Call beforehand. Contact your accommodation and transport providers in advance and be completely open and honest about your accessibility needs so they can support you and assist you when you arrive if needed. Be organised. Have all documents and information to hand or in your phone, including emergency contacts just in case you get lost. And don't forget your phone charger with an adapter if you're travelling abroad. Check out apps. If you use a smartphone, you could try a few sight loss apps before you go, such as Seeing AI and Be My Eyes, to see if you find them useful, plus magnification. Google Maps and language translation. Plan your itinerary. The more planning you do beforehand, the better your break will be. Plan your day trips and routes and book assisted travel if required so that you don't miss out on the tourist attractions you really want to visit. Book guided tours. Lots of holiday destinations offer guided walking, bus or boat tours, which can be so much easier and more relaxing than trying to find your own way around, plus more interesting. You may be able to book these before you go. Decorate luggage. If you're getting a flight, stick something bright on your luggage to make it easier to identify at the airport. You could also ask your travel companion to wear something bright so they stand out in the crowd. Complete a PEP, hotels and other accommodation should ask you to complete a personal evacuation plan, PEP, before or when you arrive. This is a customised plan for people who may need help evacuating due to disabilities or impairments.
What to pack? For people with sight loss, it can be a challenge to manage day-to-day life in unfamiliar territory. Here are some of the things to take with you that can help. A spare cane. Take a spare cane in case one gets lost or broken, or whatever other specialist aids you rely on. You might also want a torch for dimly lit spaces. A small bag. Take a small crossbody bag for essential items like money, keys, documents and phone, and always keep it on you when you're out and about. A pouring aid. If you're staying in a hotel or self-catering accommodation, a liquid level indicator can help prevent spills and burns when you make your cuppa. A talking clock. A talking alarm clock is an essential for many of our veterans, particularly if they're likely to be jet-lagged. Some accessible hotels may provide these. Bright ties. It can be useful to take a few brightly coloured ties to wrap around door handles and bedposts to help you navigate your way around your room. Key trackers. Bluetooth key trackers help you find your keys or other items by beeping. You could even use one to help locate the bathroom, especially at night. Bumpens. Bumpens are little tactile markers you stick on objects to help identify them, such as a shampoo bottle or a button on the safe in your hotel room. Sunscreen stick. A solid sunscreen stick is much less messy and easier to apply than cream from a bottle, and a hat and light clothing is a must for covering up in the sun.
Worth remembering, wherever you choose to stay, the most important thing is to let them know beforehand that you may need extra support getting there and finding your way around. According to the Equality Act 2010, a hotel can't refuse to serve you for a reason related to your disability, and you should be able to expect the same level of service as everyone else. Based on the experiences of our veterans, we can safely say that most places will be more than happy to accommodate your needs.
Both the RNIB and Blind Veterans website list a number of companies that specifically cater for visually impaired holidaymakers.
The meaning behind Darlington's name, It's Not About Wool, by Joshua Nicol in the Northern Echo. Darlington's earliest recorded name was Dirthington, first noted around 1040, derived from the Old English Deonothingtun. The name is believed to translate roughly as the settlement of Deonoth's people, referring to an Anglo-Saxon figure named Deonoth, whose personal name combined the elements Deor, meaning deer, and Noth, meaning daring or bold. Nothing else is known about Deonoth himself, but his name effectively became attached to the entire settlement that grew up around his farm or estate on the banks of the River Skern. The town's name went through several changes over the centuries as spelling conventions shifted. By Norman times it had become Durlington, recorded in 1457, before further variations including Darnton and Darlington, gradually emerging during the following centuries. The nickname Darnton stuck around locally for generations and not always affectionately. In the 17th century, the town was famously mocked as Darnton i' the Dirt, a jibe inspired by its unpaved, muddy streets, said to have even prompted King James VI of Scotland, or James I of England, to compose a mocking rhyme about the town during a visit in 1603. Darlington's origins as an Anglo-Saxon settlement predate the Norman conquest by centuries, with the town developing on the banks of the River Skern, a tributary of the Tees. Like much of the northeast, the area later fell under Viking control, with the Danes taking over Northumbria, including the land around Darlington. By 866 AD, leaving a lasting Norse influence on place names across the wider region. Towards the end of the 10th century, the settlement and its dependencies were granted to St Cuthbert, patron saint of Durham's bishopric, in the presence of King Ethelred, cementing Darlington's early ties to the church that would shape much of its subsequent history. Despite how it sounds today, Darlington's name has no connection to the word darling, nor to the linen and wool trade the town would later become known for. It's a coincidence of modern pronunciation rather than etymology, with the true root buried in a Saxon personal name that vanished from record almost as soon as it was written down.
Why centuries of superstitions cast this bird as a villain and an omen of ill fortune, by Mark Crocker in Country Life. If we judged magpies purely on looks, they would surely rank among the most visually arresting birds in Britain. Alas for the species, the voice is similarly arresting, albeit for the wrong reasons. The machine gun rattle is distinctive, yet supremely unmusical. It's invariably described as chattering, and one nice detail is that the sound gave the bird its Italian name, gazza, which in turn was believed by some to be the source for our word gazette, the gossipy broadsheet for the chattering classes. It is not only that grating racket that leads some to dislike magpies, but the same issue that condemns many of the other in our unloved birds club, their robust prosperity in modern suburban Britain. Magpies have had a great half century and more than doubled their numbers since the 1960s, with the national total put at 610,000 pairs. It should be said that the increases followed centuries of persecution, and it is from an old suppressed place that the species has rebounded. The recovery was also underway from the early 20th century. However, that increase has closely mirrored declines in many of our most wonderful songbirds: house martins, willow and marsh tits, nightingales, missel and song thrushes, to name only a few. The tendency is to make this link causative, to assume that thrushes have gone because magpies have flourished. It is indubitably the case that magpies are nest predators, taking the eggs and young of other songbirds. It is equally true that seeing magpies rip apart a nest and carry away helpless chicks is a visceral, often upsetting experience. Yet the powerful impact of the encounter doesn't equate to a principle of ecology. No matter how offensive it might be, it is not proof that magpies are the key reason for declines in other species. Firstly, we have to admit that the magpie doesn't come to us with a clean moral sheet. Centuries of superstitions cast the bird as a villain or as an omen of ill fortune. The one for sorrow rhyme, once known to every schoolchild, is only the tip of a folkloric iceberg. Another notion is that magpies are habitual thieves. These ancient ideas freight the species with negative associations and place it in the frame as a scapegoat. However, the main allowance we have to make for magpies derives not from an admission of our past superstitions, but from our acceptance of the facts. There have been several studies demonstrating how songbirds flourish in precisely the places where magpies have themselves done well. One of those studies was completed at the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust's research and demonstration farm at Loddington, Leicestershire. It looked at the effect of three predatory species and concluded that there is no convincing evidence of an impact of these corvids on songbird breeding abundance. The evidence indicates that songbird populations are resilient to predation. In short, songbirds have many young, including several broods in a season, and although many might be lost, including some to magpies, the overall total is sustained. If such evidence doesn't exonerate magpies in totality, it does indisputably illustrate a central principle that is so often a casualty in these bird disputes. Working out the ecology of British nature, where thousands of species are interconnected, is enormously difficult. Following a single linear path through it and finding simple, sometimes simplistic answers to enormously complex questions might be tempting, however, it is not the same as truth. When all this is said, it doesn't mean those who dislike the corvid with the jaunty swagger and the rattling voice will find a way to love it. Equally, those who cherish magpies for their beauty and resilience won't condemn the bird for eating thrushes occasionally. This, after all, is life. It is we, ultimately, who have to learn to live with one another, just as in nature, magpies live alongside garden thrushes.
So that brings us to the end of this edition of The Talking Newspaper. My thanks to all involved in this week's production. Don't forget, we want to hear from you with any comments you have about the recordings. Do call us on Darlington 465 101. If there is no one in the office to answer your call, leave a message and we will get back to you. Or you can email us at dtnewspaper@outlook.com. Until next time, look after yourselves. From me, Pat Walker, and all the team, goodbye. Thank you.